faced with this major challenge of our time, our leaders seem to be either blind or resigned, or something more. Martin Woods has witnessed this deadly addiction. He was involved in the greatest money laundering scandal ever. In 2005, this ex-Scotland Yard man was engaged by the London branch of the big American bank, Wachovia. Woods soon identified clients linked to Casas de Cambio, the Mexican Money Exchange Bureau.
What we saw were large batches of traveler's checks, sequentially numbered, bearing illegible signatures, no dates, and critically, no identification features upon the rear of any of the checks to enable me to ascertain who it was who presented the checks. Back to basics, who was the customer? We couldn't see that.
Martin Woods alerted his bosses. He didn't know he was not alone. The U.S. federal authorities were also watching Wachovia, especially after the Mexican army intercepted a plane in 2006. Hired by the cartel of Sinaloa, the plane was full of cocaine. The investigation showed it was bought with money passing through the Wachovia bank.
There were some bankers who were engaged in marketing this service to Casas de Cambio customers and providing banking services that were used to launder money. And when I confronted and challenged this, I was confronted, challenged, and even attacked by the bankers for my own conduct.
Despite the evidence gathered by Woods, the bank ignored this and directed all its criticisms towards him.
I didn't have support from my departmental bosses. In fact, I found no support there whatsoever. And it took the bank a long time to realize that money did not control me. Money did not influence me in the same way that it influenced them. And this was rarely emphasized when my boss telephoned me in 2009 to tell me that my bonus for 2008 was zero. That was a very defining moment.
The outcome of this exemplary story is Woods was fired. When the American justice system caught up with Wachovia in March 2010, it got off with a ridiculously low fine.
I cannot explain or understand why the Justice Department decided not to prosecute the Wachovia managers. Perhaps something is related to the crisis and the fear that, after the collapse of a big bank in the U.S., Lehman Brothers, another big bank, Wachovia, would fail. That may be an explanation. But it may also show that the presence of mafia money is so strong that it has become irreversible and they are not even prosecuting.
In 2008, Wachovia was bought by a rival, Wells Fargo, which paid the bill, a fine of $150 million. Grotesque, when we know that in total, Wachovia laundered $378 billion. An astonishing sum, one-fifth of France's GNP.
I cannot honestly think of one single bank in the world that has not been touched by this problem. To an extent that some of my very militant colleagues who are concerned about all this say that it is not mafia looking for banks, they're banks looking for mafia money.
I think, you know, there were bankers who have to question themselves and perhaps should be questioned by authorities as to what they were doing. Ultimately, how close is a launderer's finger to the trigger of the killer's gun? Who knows?
While on the surface, we see that the integrity of banking and financial services depends heavily on the perception that it functions within a framework of high legal, professional, and ethical standards. And a reputation for integrity is one of the most valuable assets of a financial institution. The fact is that the policy of silence prevails, and criminal finance is shaping the economic, political, and social landscape of our modern world. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United Kingdom will not seek away the Northern Ireland Brexit Protocol, despite renewed calls for its abolition by the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, Britain's Brexit Minister David Frost has said. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's Brexit correspondent Lisa O'Carroll. The piece is titled, David Frost, Irish Sea Row Risks Damaging UK-EU Relations Long Term. The United Kingdom will not sweep away the Northern Ireland Brexit Protocol despite renewed calls for its abolition by the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, Britain's Brexit Minister David Frost has said. However, David Frost renewed his demands for fundamental changes to its implementation, warning the row could have a long-term chilling effect on wider EU-UK relations unless it was resolved. I worry that if we didn't solve this issue, It is capable of generating the sorts of cold mistrust which will last between us and the European Union. And the mistrust will spread across the whole relationship and will hold back the potential for a new era of cooperation between us in a world which does need us to work together, he said at the British-Irish Association conference in Oxford on Saturday, 4th of September. The row over the protocol, known in some quarters as sausage wars, blew up within days of Brexit being enforced back in January, with barriers imposed for the first time for trade of food, plants and medicines from Great Britain. But with talks set to resume, David Frost told the meeting of senior public figures that triggering Article 16 and suspending the Northern Ireland Protocol was not his preferred option, even though the threshold for such a move had been met. Some would like us to sweep everything away. That's not our position, David Frost told the delegates at the conference. He called on the European Union to engage seriously with proposals for radical changes to the protocol published in a United Kingdom government command paper in July, arguing the proposals do not remove the Northern Ireland protocol and actually retain controls in the Irish Sea for certain purposes. He said society would not forgive either side if they did not make the small muscle movements needed to make the protocol work. When one looks at the price of failure or success and sets it against other challenges that we face in COVID recovery and Afghanistan, one wonders what future generations would say if the impasse is not broken. We have no interest at all in having a fractious and difficult relationship with the European Union, he said. David Frost was speaking just hours after the Irish Prime Minister said at the same conference in Oxford that unilateral moves by the United Kingdom would always be doomed to failure, arguing that history showed partnerships were the only route to success. Talks over implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol have continued between officials in London and Brussels over the summer, but senior sources say engagement is slow, and it is unlikely an agreement will be reached by 30th of September, indicating talks will extend into the winter months. David Frost said the protocol had to be modified to recognize two sovereign and autonomous entities, not a relationship of subordination or one where one party's rules have to be applied mechanically by the other. The Northern Ireland Secretary, Brandon Lewis, told the same conference in Oxford that the United Kingdom was powering ahead with plans to level up Northern Ireland by announcing a £730 million investment into the new Peace Plus programme to support economic stability, peace and reconciliation in Northern Ireland. Brandon Lewis spoke about the economic successes of the region, including the development of a large cybersecurity sector employing 2,300 staff, but said overall it still punches well below its weight, with pockets of unacceptable levels of deprivation, and much more to be done on segregation in schools in Northern Ireland, with just 7% of children benefiting from integrated education.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesley. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the United States is anything but united these days. Inside the country lies much discontent and a major divide. And outside the country, even Washington's allies are starting to say that U.S. hegemony is waning rapidly, especially after the Afghanistan debacle. Are we looking at the beginning of the end of the American empire, or are we rapidly approaching its dissolution? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this and more on this Spotlight.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower, but a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the Spotlight, Senior Analyst, Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York. And journalist and political analyst Elijah Mahia out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off with Ian in New York. Ian, do you think that the U.S. is waning? And if so, when do you think this actually started? Some say from 1971 when gold no longer backed the dollar. Others say since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, what's your assessment of this overall?
It's very difficult to say. It's been waning almost the minute it was established, because people successfully stood against it. You could say that the Vietnamese victory against the U.S. was a clear signal, but it was definitely at its height after the fall of the Berlin Wall, after the fall of the Soviet Union, and with the Iraq War. The U.S. was unchallenged internationally. Even its enemies didn't really dare go against it. That's been eroded totally. But what happened in Afghanistan was not significant in economic or military terms. It was significant in terms of prestige. which, as far as global diplomacy is concerned, is almost as important. But people are still going to think twice before they challenge the US. They still have hugely disproportionate armed forces. They still have hugely disproportionate financial support, less so than it was, and it's definitely waning, and a lot less quickly than some of us would have hoped, perhaps. But it's also got rising, it's got rising rivals, in particular China. I don't really think that Russia is one of the major rivals. It's Russia is sort of Saudi Arabia with nuclear weapons. It doesn't have a massive economy, but it does have this residual armed forces and nuclear weapons. China is a rising power in every sense, and obviously the US is scared about it. But once again, the US isn't unrivaled there, and China can't really exploit the US's weakness, because one of the reasons why China has been rising is because it sells so much of its goods to the United States, and it borrows so much money from the United States, it lends so much money to the United States, so they're inextricably bound together. It's not a straight one-on-one superpower confrontation like Moscow and Washington in what you might say the bad old days, when they really didn't have that much to do with each other. There was almost minimal contact in culturally, financially, and other ways. But the United States is a victim of its own failures.
Stay with me. We're going to talk about the reasons for this, but let me get Elijah in on this conversation. Now, American political scientist Francis Fukuyama says that the truth of the matter is that the end of the American era had come much earlier. The long-term sources of American weakness and decline are more domestic than international. What do you think about that?
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming.
I think the decline of the U.S. forces started not when the U.S. was engaged in war, like in Lebanon 1982 or 1983, in Iraq in 2003, in Syria 2011. It is, what is the outcome of all these wars? Of course, the U.S. has the strongest military machine and military power, but what is the result of this machine? It winning the ground and then not be able to hold it. It's exactly the same as ISIS is able today to attack small villages and win and then withdraw. But the U.S. is able to stay for much longer, for many years, and then being kicked out and forced to withdraw. The moment the Americans sit with the Taliban and negotiate a peace deal is the moment of the decline and the defeat of the U.S. after 20 years. So there is no point for the U.S. to have so much the mighty military power when the result is very slim at the end of the day. So yes, it is a decline of the empire. It is the rising of other forces that not only are rival, but also are defying the U.S. and challenging the U.S. Forces, even if they don't stand to the exact U.S. Military power, and they have a minor force. But however, they can and they are able to defy the U.S., like we've seen that in Iran, we've seen that in Syria, we've seen that in Lebanon, and we've seen that in Iraq, even a small group. And the Taliban managed to stand against the Americans and force the withdrawal. So, yes, I think the U.S. Defense Secretary is quite right by saying it is just a big power, but it's a big power not able to reach the end, achieve anything at the end of the day.
Okay, well, Ian, there have always been different opinions in the U.S., like most places, but it was magnified greatly during the Trump era. How divided do you actually think the country is currently?
It's extremely divided. And I just want to add that the people who brought you the Iraq War were the people behind the project for the new American century. And they foresaw this precisely. In their own way, they were clear-sighted. They said America was declining economically, and so they had to cement in a military advantage now to to ensure their hegemony over the next few years. And they're proved entirely right, apart from the fact of being hopelessly optimistic. And what we're seeing now is there's always been a problem with American foreign policy. It's never been, it's never been joined up. It's a result of different lobbies of forces within there. It's almost Byzantine in the way that the State Department, the Pentagon, the military industrial contractors, the politicians representing the lobbies, where they kick things around until it comes. And then, in the past, you had the State Department acting like a gyroscope and saying, well, yes, you might want that, but international law says no. Jerusalem is not Israel's capital. Or international law says, no, Western Sahara is not part of Morocco, no matter what the President of the United States says. But that type of moderating influence is almost gone, because one of the things that Trump and the ideologues did was to wage a complete war against the State Department and the more rational aspects of the American foreign policy establishment. So in that sense, what Joe Biden has done is entirely rational. He said, we can't win in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not one of our essential, it's not one of our essential fields of operation for the United States. The United States interests are not inextricably bound up there. Prestige might be, but we can live with their prestige. We're still the biggest military in the world. And then, the old story about sticks and stones may break my bones, but the names will love me. Okay, I'm not the big superpower. Try anything on me and see what I do. It's a rational position that Biden has taken, but it is symbolic of American decline and the decline of the decision-making apparatus that universally the political, military, and intelligence people let Biden down so thoroughly that he did not know that the Taliban had basically entered into an agreement and they bought the Afghan army wholesale on the ground, unit by unit.
You talk about that it's a logical thing to do, the rational thing to do. I think probably the question, though, for the American people and much of the world would be the way that they did what they did and why did they leave in the way that they did and cause such chaos. And what does that do to the American psyche itself? Because the American people, first of all, don't like to believe that they've been beaten, that they've lost the war, number one. And second of all, they don't like to hear that some have been left behind and basically American troops are running out of Afghanistan. I mean, what has that done in general for the American psyche inside of the country?
The American psyche, as far as I can see, is completely unflappable. Really, they really don't care. Afghanistan is a faraway country with a strange-sounding name, and most Americans are just happy to get out of there. Some of them might see it as a blot on their escutcheon, another way of looking at it, if you're being rational, bearing in mind that it was a completely unprecedented collapse, that was the real failure, the fact that that wasn't anticipated. The U.S. showed its power. It got out over 100,000 people in a very short time from allegedly a hostile territory with very few casualties and very few left behind. It's shameful, but actually that shame is mostly brought on by the Trump people who brought about the debacle to begin with, who are picking on Biden for partisan points. I'm not a fan of Biden, but this was one of the more rational things, and a lot of what he's been accused of goes squarely back to Donald Trump and the Republicans who started this thing. Now, okay. Biden was one of the cheerleaders for those foreign adventures as part of the sort of neocon conspiracy to defend Israel, but on this particular aspect, he was clear-sighted. We couldn't win enough, and we have to get out.
Elijah, your assessment of it all, and what do you see as the main causes of the U.S.'s deterioration?
I think there are many points here. It is not only the rush that the U.S. left Afghanistan. It is also the behavior toward the allies. I mean, here, Europe is under shock to see how the U.S. withdrew without even consulting Europe, and the way they withdrew without talking to the allies. And this is why we're here today to talk about the necessity to form a European army, which is very early, and I don't know where this is going to lead us. However, the reason why the U.S. felt in such a hurry to leave is because they had a wrong information, a wrong assessment of the army that they have trained, and they had a very high expectation.
How does that happen? Sorry to jump in here, Elijah. I mean, how does that happen? You say wrong assessment. 20 years on the ground, 20 years American troops working or being side by side with Afghan troops, obviously evaluating the situation. How do you get it so wrong after 20 years?
Because the Americans make mistakes after mistakes. This is not the first time. And when because they lack also the understanding of the culture, they made this mistake in Iraq severely, and they did it again in Afghanistan when they expected to see the Afghan army engage in a civil war against other Afghani while they are negotiating with them in Qatar and delivering the country back to the Taliban. And they expect the army to fight and give them just 6 months' time so they can pull out all the Americans and the Afghan collaborators. And they say, done, we are out, and now you can continue fighting until you kill each other, and Taliban will again overwhelm all the army that we've trained for 20 years. This is a real failure that we've seen also in Iraq in 2014, where they've trained the army for 11 years, and the Iraqi army crumbled in just 3 days in Mosul and in the north of Iraq. It is not only the failure of the intelligence services, it is not the lack of visibility and right assessment, it is not only the non-understanding of the state and the local culture, it is just everything was going wrong. And because they think, well, the Americans think, we can import our culture anywhere we go, this is fundamentally wrong. They are never going to change the culture of a country, and it's never going to be customized to the Americans' culture and mentality. Nobody asked the Americans to come, and nobody asked, and they were forced to leave. After 20 years, they removed the Taliban in 2001 to give back the power in 2021 again to the Taliban.
Ian, even during a pandemic and health crisis, we have seen anything but solidarity in the way the American society has approached the issue. I mean, do you attribute this to a major mistrust by many of their leadership overall? And how does this affect the whole, the schism that has come about inside of the country? Is there overall mistrust for the leadership?
Well, I mean, you quoted at the beginning Francis Fukuyama, who wrote just before the end of the Cold War about after the end of the Cold War about the end of history, when in fact history had just restarted where it left off in 1914. And to give him his due, Francis Fukuyama has admitted he was wrong about that thesis. And here, in effect, we're seeing the American Civil War still continuing after 160 years. I mean, the issues of race and privilege and culture are still hugely predominant here. I mean, we have Texas just passed an act which basically encourages vigilantism against women. We have almost post-Reconstruction states legislatures all over the South enacting legislation that makes it almost impossible for minorities and poor people to vote. And this is being done without interference on the federal level. We have a party which tried to stage a coup against its own government on January the 6th. We have a failed president who's proclaiming he still won. These are not the hallmarks of a sophisticated and balanced society. This is a society that's riven down the middle, and there are people who hate each other. You know, 30-40% of Americans don't believe you can be patriotic and a Democrat. They certainly don't believe you can be patriotic and a socialist. They have their own very peculiar definitions, and it's a society that's based on exclusion and hatred on their part. They're actually dying in thousands because they think that wearing masks is a form of subservience to socialism, to galloping communism. They're refusing vaccinations in the middle of a death-dealing plague. I mean, you know, it's difficult. The German word is Schadenfreude, to take pleasure of the misfortunes and others. But I can't help grinning every time I see the latest right-wing radio commentator dying of COVID after he's run his latest rampage about vaccination and masks. They're still dying, though. Until they hit the hospital bed and the tubes are rammed down their throats, what's coming the other way out of their throats are invocations to resist the government, resist masks, watch out for those Democrats, they're coming after your daughters and everything else. It really is a very sick society, and there's it goes back to the Civil War, but it was Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan who saw those fissures were still there and started the process of enlarging the fissures, of basically playing the race card, which they've done year after year. And now it's an even bigger, it's a culture card, where, you know, any minorities are the target for vilification and witch hunts. It's not a stable society. And what's worse is that the people who actually make the decisions in Washington, the last 20 years of hollowing out by the Republicans, they've taken away. For years, if you spoke Arabic in the State Department, you were denied promotion. And you were talking about how could they? When the Shah was driven out of Tehran, U.S. mission people were still sending back rosy reports because none of them read Farsi. They didn't see all the graffiti on the street walls saying death to the Shah on their way in. They probably thought it was an advert for Coca-Cola. They did not know what was happening in the country they were stationed in because of their cultural arrogance.
Well, what about that, Elijah? I mean, now when we look at the situation and the overall situation of the U.S., many will say that it's a dying empire. It's under lots of pressure right now as far as its so-called prestige in the world. Other analysts will say it's some of the most dangerous times when an empire feel pressured. Your take on where this can go with the United States basically waning, as Ian said at the beginning, it may be waning, but it still has a lot of power. Your assessment of it at this point in time?
I think we are in a very dangerous situation today. The danger comes from an administration that wants to show that it has not been defeated and it still had the power to do something. And that will take us to the possibility of American just supporting another war somewhere or a battle between in West Asia. Secondly, the Americans, if they are smart enough to understand that they cannot sustain a presence in country where there is no interest to stay, like, for example, in northeast Syria, that is even exactly the same as Afghanistan, is so far, there is no interest for the Americans to stay there. It's staying in Iraq when the population, half of the population at least, is against them and carrying a tax. So if they reach this realization that it is time to stop being involved in country that are far, there is no interest for the American, and they have to withdraw, then the world will be really in a better shape.
Okay.
Otherwise, you see, really an American administration committing one mistake after another.
Well, Ian, really quickly, I just have a minute, though. But what Elijah said, if they will do this and understand that it's not in their benefit. But one of the things we can look at is, yes, the U.S. hasn't spent a lot of money on its own people and the infrastructure, but it has spent trillions on its wars, and it has benefited the industrial military complex, the 1%. I mean, are we going to see a change? Because basically, what the U.S. is like a major corporation and supporting that 1%. All the others are basically just workers for that 1%. Do you think that we're likely to see a change in tactics, or is it just going to continue until it dissolves?
Actually, I think the Biden administration has done, I had low expectations. I think they've done far more than I anticipated in terms of rising the corner for the weaker segments of American society. They're not doing enough, but it's far better. And speaking of weaker segments, I think you mentioned the UK before. The UK, for the last 70 years, has droned on about the special relationship, and it's been revealed once again to be entirely one-sided. Britain sends troops to every war that the Americans send to them. These are the goodness of the sepoys, the Indian colonial army that the British sent everywhere. So the British have been sent by the Americans to wars all over the world, but things that aren't in British interests were in American interests. And then they were left in Kabul with no attempt to rescue them or consult with them. They were left swinging, like all the other European allies, as Elijah said. I mean, this, if Biden is to be accused of anything, that complete insouciance and contempt for allies will come back to haunt them. The Europeans are going to try and build their own forces. The Taiwanese are going to think to themselves, and the Japanese even are going to think, maybe we need nuclear weapons. If this is what allies do to each other, we need to stand up for ourselves. There are dangerous implications everywhere. There are worse things than a bipolar system. A multipolar system with lots of people waving nukes could be much more dangerous.
Okay, 30 seconds, Elijah. 30 seconds.
I think it's time for the U.S. to realize that stop interfering in other countries' affairs, lift the sanction on Iran, allow Iraq to sort out this problem, and countries in West Asia to talk to each other and keep away, really keep away, and withdraw all forces. That is a dream. It may come true.
All right, and on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this Spotlight, Senior Analyst Foreign Policy and Focus Ian Williams out of New York, and Journalist and Political Analyst Elijah McNair out of Brussels. And we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, roundtable discussions, culture, politics, all produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Louisiana communities battered by Hurricane Ida are now dealing with the possibility of weeks without power in the stifling late summer heat. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kevin McGill, reporter. This article is titled Ida's Sweltering Aftermath in U.S. No power, no water, no gasoline. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Hundreds of thousands of Louisianans sweltered in the aftermath of Hurricane Ida recently with no electricity, no tap water, precious little gasoline, and no clear idea of when things might improve. Long lines that wrapped around the block formed at the few gas stations that had fuel and generator power to pump it. People cleared rotting food out of refrigerators. Neighbors shared generators and borrowed buckets of swimming pool water to bathe or to flush toilets. We have a lot of work ahead of us, and no one is under the illusion that this is going to be a short process, Governor John Bel Edwards said as the cleanup and rebuilding began across the region in the oppressive late summer heat. New Orleans officials announced 7 places around the city where people could get a meal and sit in air conditioning. The city was also using 70 transit buses as cooling sites and will have drive-through food, water, and ice distribution locations set up recently. Edwards said the state officials also were working to set up distribution locations in the other areas. Mayor Latoya Cantrell said she expects the main power company Energy to be able to provide some electricity to the city, but stressed that doesn't mean a quick citywide restoration. Energy was looking at 2 points to begin powering critical infrastructure in the area, such as hospitals, nursing homes, and first responders, the company said in a news release. Cantrell acknowledged frustration in the days ahead for the people. "We know it's hot. We know we do not have any power, and that continues to be a priority," she told a news conference. More than 1 million homes and businesses in Louisiana and Mississippi, including all of New Orleans, were left without power when auto slammed the electric grid with its 150 meters per hour winds, toppling a major transmission tower and knocking out thousands of miles of lines and hundreds of substations. An estimated 25,000 plus utility workers labored to restore electricity, but officials said it could take weeks or months. With water treatment plants overwhelmed by floodwaters or crippled by power outages, some places were also facing shortages of drinking water. About 441,000 people in 17 parishes had no water, and an additional 319,000 were under boil water advisories, federal officials said. The number of deaths climbed to at least 4 in Louisiana and Mississippi, including 2 people killed when 7 vehicles plunged into a 20-foot deep hole near Lucidale, Mississippi, where a highway had collapsed after torrential rains. Among the crash victims was Kent Brown, a well-liked 49-year-old father of 2. His brother, Kate Brown, said in a telephone interview recently. Kate Brown said his brother was in construction but had been out of work for a while. He didn't know where his brother was headed when the crash happened. Edwards said he expects the death toll to rise. In Slidell, crews searched for a 71-year-old man who was attacked by an alligator that tore off his arm as he walked through Ida's floodwaters. His wife pulled him to the steps of the home and paddled away to get help, but when she returned, he was gone, authorities said. On Grand Isle, the barrier island that bore the full force of Ida's winds, police chief Scooter Resweber said he was amazed that no one was killed or even seriously injured. About half of the properties on the island of about 1,400 people were heavily damaged or destroyed, and the main roadway was nearly completely covered in sand brought in from the tidal surge. In New Orleans, drivers lined up for roughly a quarter mile waiting to get into a Costco that was one of the few spots in the city with gasoline. At other gas stations, motorists occasionally pulled up to the pumps, saw the handles covered in plastic bags, and drove off. Ranil Dibas spent a week suffering in the New Orleans Superdome after 2005 Hurricane Katrina, which killed 1,800 people and left the city nearly uninhabitable. She said she is willing to give it a few days without electricity, but no more than that. Michael Pinkra used his dwindling fuel to find food. He cradled his three-week-old son in the back seat of an SUV, and his two-year-old daughter played in front of seat as his wife stood in a long line in the sweltering heat to get into one of the few grocery stores open in the city. Pinkra said he and his wife thought about evacuating but couldn't find a hotel room. They found out about the open store through social media, but even that link was tenuous. He said, "We can't charge our electronic devices to keep in contact with people, and without that, all of the communication just fails." In hard-hit Houma, the dismal reality of life without air conditioning, refrigeration, or other more basic supplies began to sink in. Our desperate need right now is tarps, gasoline for generators, food, and water. Pastor Chad Duke said, he said a church group from Mississippi arrived with food and supplies and neighbors came to his pool to scoop up buckets of water. And adding to the misery was the steamy weather. A heat advisory was issued for New Orleans and the rest of the region, with forecasters saying the combination of high temperatures and humidity could make it feel like 105 degrees Fahrenheit or 41 degrees Celsius. Cynthia Andrews couldn't go back to her New Orleans home if she wanted to. She was in a wheelchair tethered by a power cord to the generator system running the elevators and hallway lights at Lee Meridian Hotel. When the power went out recently, the machine that helps Andrews breathe after a long collapse in 2018 stopped working. The hotel let her stay in the lobby, giving her a cot after she spent nearly a whole night in her wheelchair. She said, "It was so scary, but as long as this thing keeps running, I will be okay."